demande ce que c'est Paris. On répond toujours l'étoile, les Tuileries, la boîte de Boulogne et la boîte de Vincennes, les petites boutiques des quais de la Seine.
D'autres plus sérieux disent sans hésiter, c'est la petite roquette ou bien c'est la santé.
C'est les grands boulevards, il y a l'opéra, mais ne les croyez pas.
So that is Jacques Hélien singing A Paris Tour I Felt. I can't pronounce it properly, let's be honest about it. The song tells the story that there would be no Paris without its most famous tower, which, by the way, celebrated its 125th year anniversary just gone on Monday. Now, as it happens, French correspondent from France, our French correspondent, we like to call her, from France 24 is here today, Siobhan Silk. Siobhan, you're very welcome to the programme. You're just home for a flying visit.
I am, and it's so nice to be here in person since we've been on the phone and we've been in another studio talking remotely. So it's lovely to meet everyone.
Well, you're welcome to come in. Now you know what it looks like. I suppose the studios in Paris are much swankier than the ones we have here, are they?
Well, the studios are studios at France 24, France 24. We also are partnered with RFI, which is Radio France International, and they've actually have brand new studios that they used to be in another part of Paris, and they've moved in beside us, and they have very beautiful studios. But these Orti studios are wonderful too.
They're old though. Who pays for France 24?
It's government funded actually, and there's also so taxpayers, and there is also some advertising. But yeah, it's a public channel.
It's news all the way, sort of thing.
24 hours a day,
really,
which means a 4 a.m. start for me. I'm leaving here on Friday, and I won't even be going home. I'll be going. I'm arriving into Paris at about midnight, and I usually just go straight to the office and try and sleep for a bit because I start at 4 in the morning on Saturday, that's my Saturday, 4 in the morning.
My goodness, for how long? How many? What kind of shift do you do?
That's actually not too bad because when we're on the early morning shift, it's a short shift. It's only 6 or 7 hours. So thanks to French labour laws, they're quite gentle on us. So
yeah, what are the French labour laws like? Because I saw the Muppets Most Wanted movie. And I saw it a couple of weeks ago, but it's only just kind of come into the general release now. And one of the characters in it is a French detective, not quite an Inspector Clouseau, but he keeps looking at his watch. So time for lunch. And then he's on holidays with the family during the investigation because of French labour laws. And I kind of thought, well, how good are they?
Well, we do have the famous 35-hour work week, which is very controversial. And the conservative, the right-wing parties are not usually in favour of that. They think we need more for productivity. We should be working more. The 35-hour work week is really a beloved of the socialists and of unions and of most French workers.
But I wonder, would people be more productive if they're working 40 hours a week?
I mean, I think
just because you're working, like, presenteeism doesn't mean there's a better productivity regime
and
in place.
I have read that French workers are statistically extremely productive. I know that in Japan, where you're expected to be at the office morning, noon and night, a lot of people are just sleeping at their desks. It's just that you have to be there. They're not actually necessarily working. Germany is another country where people tend to come in at 9 and they leave at 5 and they do their work day, but they're efficient. And they're, I mean, I know it's the stereotype of Germany, but they're productive and efficient. So I think, I think French workers are very efficient.
I remember working for the BBC Natural History Unit back in the early 90s. And I was working on a project, developing a programme for Radio 4, as it happens. And at any rate, long story short, go in the morning at kind of 8:30, 9 o'clock or something, and leave at 4:30, whatever the case may be. And people were sitting at their desks all day long, and I wondered sometimes, what were they doing?
Well, I will say,
because I was making the phone call when I went in. I wasn't hanging around to make the phone call, whatever phone call needed to be made. A little bit of research, then check something else. And then I would do something. And I'd have it done. I was thinking by lunchtime, I'm finished. Do I have to actually sit here? And it was for 2 weeks when I was thinking, do I have to sit here? And it got to the point by the end of the week, I said, I'm going home. I'd actually done what I was supposed to do.
I
wondered what everybody else was doing. But they make brilliant programmes, don't get me wrong, but I did notice this. It did stay with me.
I will say that a lot of my colleagues at France 24 do work very long hours because I work in the newsroom working on the hourly programmes, and there's a shift. So when I finish my shift, there is another journalist who comes in to replace me on this constant 24-hour cycle. So now. Obviously, I do stay late sometimes to finish stuff, but you know, I do have colleagues and friends who are, say, working on weekly programs, and they're working much longer hours. They're just, you know, they've got to get their program finished in a week.
And are you on air? Are you on-air talent, or are you just preparing bulletins for newscasters to read?
I do basically voiced packages. So I'm putting together pictures and script and voicing. And now and again, I fill in on sport. I present our sports bulletin, but that's with reluctance, because I'm not the best person to be filling in. I don't know my
sports. Can I ask, Siobhan, how much writing are you actually doing? I mean, you're taking a lot of the stuff off the wires, in inverted commas, correct? The news is coming in from various news sources.
Exactly.
And are you just regurgitating what's written as it comes in, or
we're also speaking to our correspondents. I mean, we have a lot of correspondents out there. But most of the packages I'm putting together, they would be stories where we wouldn't necessarily be sending our correspondents there. They'd be the smaller stories, or they'd be updates, or they'd be, it's just that very fast moving 24-hour news, you know, constant updates. So, you know, our deadlines are, you know, not tomorrow or next week. They're sort of in the next hour or two.
And can I ask, is there a market for it?
Well, we're quite well watched in Ireland, actually. We have we do have a lot of viewers in Ireland, especially because when TG Car finishes their broadcast for the day.
France 24. That's how I came across it first. And in fact, a lot of Irish voices on France 24.
There are. We do have quite a few Irish colleagues. Stephen Carroll, he's our business editor in the morning, so people will see him on air. And James Creedon is our media editor, so in the evening people will see him on air. James Creedon from Cork and Stephen Carroll from Dublin. And one of the presenters, Claire Murphy, another Dubliner. So there's quite a number of us. Yeah, we've got a little mini Irish mafia going on there.
It sounds like there is, all right. And but I wonder about the audience for it, because it seems to me that all channels now, even our own channel, we broadcast an awful lot of news. And the Morning Ireland is the most listened to radio program in Ireland. I mean, you can't take that away from it. But after that, you wonder, is there, if you were to do that all day long, would people want it? And I wonder, a rolling news channel like your own.
Because it's a global channel. It's watched worldwide. So, you know, our morning show is prime time. It's, you know, for a certain part of the world. Our evening show is you know, even the middle of the night is prime time in the US. So that's what the 24 hour news is for. It's really for that global audience. And you know, the channel is broadcast in three languages. I work for the English service, but we're also broadcast in French and Arabic. And you know, the French, I think we're going to talk about this later. French is one of the most widely spoken languages in the world.
We can talk about it now if you want.
And we certainly can. I mean, this is when people think about the language of the future, I think people, a lot of parents might think that it would be good for their children to learn Mandarin and think that will be the most spoken word, that language that will be the most important one for people to learn. But a French investment bank, Natixis, has just done a study, and the study claims that French will be the most widely spoken native language in the world by 2050. It'll be 8% of the world's population. Now, 8% doesn't sound like a lot, but at the moment, if you're talking about native English speakers, it's only about 5%, I think, of the world speaking English natively. So that's 750 million speakers. And that's because there is this absolutely massive French-speaking population in sub-Saharan Africa. If you think of French, you think of France, you think of maybe Canada, Quebec, you think of the other European countries, but the biggest population of French speakers is in Africa, and that's the growing economy, that's the growing population. So French could become more and more important.
I was surprised to hear that it was the second most widely spoken mother tongue after German, ahead of English, in Europe.
Yes, and in fact, it's likely that it will take over German, because the French birth rate is higher than the German birth rate, and it's very possible that the population of native French speakers will overtake German French speakers. And don't forget, you've also got in Europe, you've also got Belgium, Luxembourg and Switzerland, where you've got native French speakers. So.
Yeah, we don't think about them though, do we? Just think of France, really. That's all you think of. You don't think about these other languages that are in there.
Well, and it's. I think French people don't really think about them much either. I think the Swiss accent and the Belgian accents do come in for a bit of slagging from the French. But you know, the French government is very proud of the francophonie, the French speaking world, and they do their best to encourage to encourage cooperation between. Well, this is exactly it, and they want to encourage cooperation. There is no French Commonwealth, but there's, you know, I guess the nearest thing to a French Commonwealth is the Francophonie, and you know they're encouraging. They want to encourage non-French speaking countries as well. Here in Ireland, we've got you've got the Alliance Française, which is a French government funded institution, which allows you to learn French. You've also got the Lycée Français, which is
You've also got the Institut Cervantes, which is just around the corner from the Alliance Française. So I mean, it seems like everybody's out there doing that, and there must be some equivalent Irish language base centre around in France. Is there one?
There
in
is
France?
Actually. Well, actually, the Irish Cultural Centre in Paris actually.
And can you go and learn Gaelic?
You can indeed.
Yeah. We're all out there with the tentacles. I was going to ask you something about whether or not you would actually say anything bad about France, and you get annoyed if people say things that are not particularly flattering about the French now that you live there and work there.
I think every time, because every time I come on air with you, I afterwards think I did say terrible things about France there, and I really do.
Do you worry for your security of your job?
Well, even last week, because last time I was on, we were talking about the pollution in France, and I was thinking, God, I hope that didn't come across as terribly. And I talked about homelessness the time before that. No, but you know, I don't want to give the impression that Paris is some terrible dystopia, but it's. I think when you live and work there, you do sort of forget where you are, you know, especially when you do have to go to work at 4 a.m. And you know, the France Baguette studios are very close to the Eiffel Tower, and it's only sometimes after work, if I've worked a late shift and I'm getting a taxi home, I'll pass by it in the taxi late at night, and I'll sort of, you know, glance at it and remember, oh, of course, this is where I am, and this beautiful icon is here, and you know, I do forget day to day where I am. It tends to be, there's an expression in French, métro boulot dodo, which is metro, work and sleep, and this is kind of the French treadmill, the French rat race. And so it's you know, I do need to take the time to appreciate where I am.
Now, I'm surprised you say that because of the cafe culture they have there.
Yeah, and I mean, again, we talked at one of
Metro work and sleep. Where does the cafe culture fit in? And when I was there recently, and it was the first time I'd been there since I was 15, and the last time I was on a school trip, you see nothing on the bus, off the bus, on the bus, off the bus, on the bus, off the bus. So this is the first time I actually got to see it and appreciate it and enjoy it. And but the one thing I liked most of all was the fact that you could sit down in a cafe and get a reasonable meal. It wasn't expensive in the Marais, which I was told would be expensive. On the contrary, a meal for less than 15 euro and a good meal with a beer, and see all ages, families, straight people, gay people, all sorts, sitting down together and enjoying conversation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Talking to nobody on their mobile phones. Everybody chatting.
And you
it
mentioned
was lovely.
And it's funny that you mentioned the Marais, straight families, gay families. And the Marais, it's the old Jewish quarter, and it's now the gay quarter, and it's this absolute melting pot. You've got the, you know, the traditional Orthodox Jews, and this kind of new, you know, beside the old Jewish bakeries, you've got the latest chic gay bar, and it is that the Marais in particular, and it is one of those areas with the little it still has the narrow winding streets.
It is the place to live there. There's no question about it, isn't it? And yet it's close to everything. Everything's within walking distance.
Yeah,
the Pompidou Centre is there. Yeah. I mean, the Louvre is only a 10-minute walk down to then to the same, then on to the Hunchback of Notre Dame's place. You know,
absolutely.
It's all beside it.
Absolutely. But well, although as for living there, I don't know. I think it might be a bit too much for me. I think I'm in a little sort of more to the edge of Paris, where things are a little bit quieter as well. Because it's maybe nice to visit, but I don't know if I could take it 24/7.
But to answer my question, do you get annoyed when people say bad things about France now that you live there? And you hear a negative image of France.
Do I find myself defending it? Well, it depends on what kind of thing. I mean, if the French people being rude or this kind of thing.
I didn't find them rude at all.
I mean, people will say that, and I'll always defend French people against that, because I agree with you. I don't find that either.
New Yorkers are rude.
Did you think so?
Yes, absolutely, 100%. Every single time I've been there, yeah, absolutely. But I didn't find the French people rude. I found them extremely helpful.
Except New York waiters who are working for tips
They're rude when you don't give them the tip they expect. That's what I think. Anyway, stay with us if you would, Siobhan. Nuchtinish le cuivini con quella. We're talking to Siobhan Silk, who's a journalist with France 24, and she's Irish. Which part of Ireland are you from, by the way?
I'm a Dubliner.
You are a Dubliner. Yeah, I was going to say that, but I wasn't sure, you know, wasn't sure which part of Dublin.
Blanchardstown.
Blanchardstown. Yeah. And is it your dream job out there? I mean, did you want to get into the media here and you couldn't? Or what?
What I did, well, I've kind of lived in Paris on and off because I went the first time I lived over there, I was over in 2003 and I spent 2 years there and came back here for 2 years. And I went back in the summer of 2007. Is that right? Yes, that must be it. With the intention of just staying for a couple of months and maybe doing some freelancing with France 24. And then they sort of, the couple of months of freelancing turned into a very full-time freelancing, six shifts a week. And then that turned into a permanent contract, which meant less work actually, but more stable.
Mm. Security.
And security, yes. But I know I miss home. I mean, I'm, and especially because I've got, you know, a niece and nephews now and I'm, it kind of breaks my heart to be away from them.
Aww,
so
that's sweet, isn't it?
It does, yeah. But I do, you know.
Needs must. Yes. Well, can you see yourself there for the rest of your life? Or, you know, ooh, a lot of Irish people kind of dream, well, not a lot, but some Irish people certainly dream of having that little house in the south of France and retiring to it.
Well, if I could buy an apartment in Paris, you know, that would be a lovely dream.
Why
but
can't
if you?
You're working for France 24. You're in the media.
If you want to spend €250,000 on a one room, you know, space for a bed and a corner kitchen, it's, I mean, the property prices in Paris. If you think Dublin was bad in the boom, yeah, Paris, it's very, very,
Siobhan,
very
I have news for you. Dublin is still bad.
And growing. I know
the
prices
worse.
Are, yeah. And you know, there's the thing because I have friends who kind of suggest to me, because my objection to paying €250,000 for a tiny room in Paris is it doesn't have the intrinsic value. And my friends will say, oh, but don't worry, it'll never lose value. And I say, well, we heard that before. You know, in Ireland, we heard that before. And I just, I don't know.
But are you not renters in Paris? I know in yes. Berlin, it's 60% of the population. Sorry, excuse me. I think it's 80% of the population are renters and 20% are kind of owner occupiers or investors, landlords. So in Paris, is it not the same there?
Yeah, it's I think the proportion, I'm not sure of the exact proportion, it's probably about similar, especially in the actual city of Paris. And
so then why are the prices high? I mean, if you have a city full of renters and not buyers, you would imagine that the prices, no matter how good the city was, would stay stable. For example, in Berlin, which is a major capital city in Europe, as we know, I mean, properties are relatively inexpensive there.
Well, rents are also high. So, you know, if you have the capital to make an investment in an apartment, maybe it's quite, you know, you'll get a nice return on it because rents are high. You know, it's not too bad to be a renter because there are legal protections for renters. Mm. For instance, we've just actually come out of what's called the trêve, the winter. During winter, basically, you can't be evicted from your apartment if you stop paying rent. But now that we're in spring.
That's nice. I like that. So you could pay all the way through summer, autumn.
Well, you will
and
get.
And then think, well, I'm going to move out of here in 3 months' time anyway. And you get 3 months of winter out of it free. That's a fantastic idea. I like that. You can save up.
But, I, you know, it's expensive. I mean, I sort of live quite far from work and I you know, a friend of mine moved out of her apartment very close to work and I was tempted to, you know, I wonder, could I take that over? But just the expense, there's so much expense involved in moving, you know, for apartments aren't furnished. I'd have to move all my furniture. Mm. There was not a stick of furniture. There wasn't even a kitchen in my apartment. I had to put, you know, kitchen cabinets in myself and, you know, you have to pay
massive
agency fees.
Well, then can I ask you, why do you stay?
Well,
I mean, if the quality
you know,
of life.
No,
of the
I know. I'm kind of being down on Paris. But no, it is, you know, it's easy to forget where you are when you're working and when you're on that sort of, as I said, that metro boulot dodo rat race and like me when you're working antisocial hours. But no, you know what? It is actually a beautiful city to work. You can walk across the city. There are parks on every corner, cafes on every corner, you know, public swimming pools everywhere, which are so cheap, you know. Every, you've got all the kind of tourist amenities, you've got all the museums and everything, but just for your daily for your daily life, like I said, things like swimming pools, sports facilities,
and your
all
bike
that
and your transport.
Your bike
by the way, the bikes,
everything.
My friend Stephen, if he's listening today, Stephen Falloon, was there at the weekend and they were, when I rang him, he was at the very top of the Eiffel Tower, having gone up all the steps. Now, you know how many steps it is. How many is it?
1,710. So it's not for the, it's for the fit.
Yeah, well, he's trying to get fit. Anyway, he said that it was something like, well, less than €2 per day for the bikes.
Yeah, yeah. You can either pay by the day, by the week, or by the year.
Yeah, by the day. And they said they never once got on a taxi, got on the metro, got on a bus, nothing. They got the bikes for the 3 days and less than €2 a day. And they can park them up in the places, pick another bike and off they go. €2. I thought, fantastic. Terrific.
Brilliant. And it's a very cyclable city, and even if you are trying to get fit and not it's flat. There are a couple of areas that are on hills, and actually if you're using the way the bike system works, your first half hour you pay for your daily subscription, and then your first half hour on a bike is free. If you go beyond a half hour, you have to pay a little bit extra. But in the hilly areas of Paris, they give you an extra 45 minutes to actually encourage people to cycle in the hills and park.
And you can't
be
taken off your bike in the winter, Brenda. Now, sensational, sparkling, educational, monumental, and romantic. What am I talking about?
Well, the Eiffel Tower.
The Eiffel Tower. That's what they claim anyway on their website. So, come on.
And as this song,
125th, the song we played at the beginning.
As the song that you were playing at the beginning, Paris would not be Paris without the Eiffel Tower. Can you imagine Paris without the Eiffel Tower?
No.
But the tower has narrowly escaped being demolished a couple of times. It was never meant to be permanent. It was built
for the
Grand Exhibition.
Go on, yeah, it was built
1889, and originally it only had a lease for the spot for about 20 years, and it was actually built to be dismantled. It can be taken apart, and it was not really well loved when it was first put up. Gustave Eiffel, it's Eiffel. He was not an artist, he was an engineer. And the design of the tower doesn't come from really aesthetic considerations. It's purely an engineering feat. He wanted to build the highest tower in the world, and he had to guard against wind. That was a big challenge. So that's why it has this lattice structure and why it has that iconic shape. And when it was first built, it wasn't really, really well loved, and it wasn't considered pretty at all. Maybe it still isn't very pretty. It's iron.
It's a very nice colour.
It's actually that colour has changed over the
years. No, it's green. It's a kind of greenish colour now, and it's a really nice green too. It's like a kind of British, military vehicle.
They repaint it about every 7 years, and it has been several different colours. It's kind of an olivey, browny, greeny. But you know, actually, it's a different shade at the bottom than at the top. It's got a graduated shade. It's an optical illusion.
Well, one thing that did strike me when I looked at it whenever I was there, it was the colour. The colour struck me because I thought, I used to think it was grey.
And it's been red. It's been sort of terracotta red. So right now it's that colour. So it'll be due for it to be repainted again in about 2016. So maybe they'll choose another colour again.
Well, I heard it was going to be green, white and orange. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I heard that. We should have said this yesterday.
Yesterday,
before 12 noon. We should have said the Eiffel Tower gets ready. Hey, it's going to change. It's going to the green, white and orange. But it is a beautiful monument. And it's a terrific thing to go and see.
125 years, it celebrated the birthday of Monday. And as I said, it almost got demolished, but it turned out to be very useful for communications. So they kept it going. After towards the end of World War II, there was also a danger of it being demolished again, as the Allies were closing in on Paris to liberate Paris. Hitler apparently gave the order to destroy
the whole of Paris, didn't he? Want the whole place wrecked when they were pulling out.
But the
generals didn't do it.
Well, this is exactly it. The military commander, the German military commander who was in Paris at the time, reportedly refused to give the order to do it. So 125 years after,
and it's still there. Mind you, if you were the military commander in Paris and the Allies were winning the war and they were coming to bite you on the backside, you'd be inclined to say, I was told to destroy this place, annihilate it, and I didn't. You know, you'd be saying the same thing. I wonder if it's true. Just before we finish up, talk to me about the unused metros, the forgotten metro station, should I say.
Yeah, well, the underground network, the metro network in Paris, it's absolutely massive. There are 300 active stations, but about a dozen stations that were built and closed and used and then closed and never reopened, or maybe were built and were never used, or some that just fell out of use as the network was evolved and was rerouted. So these are called ghost stations. Mm-hmm. Some of them are actually still visible if you're traveling in the metro. the lines, they're actually on active lines, just not in use. So,
so they're
fact,
just zipping through.
They're not stopping. And you'll see, you'll find yourself going very quickly through a cavernous space, and you'll see a lot of graffiti. And you might wonder, what was that? Well, that might be one of those ghost stations. Mm-hmm. Now, a couple of them are actually in use for other uses. One of them is actually a Salvation Army day centre. One of them is used as a film set. So if you ever see them, watch a French movie and part of it is set in the metro, it's probably been filmed in this station, Porte de Lilas. But there are about a dozen or so that are just left empty. And we have recently had local elections in Paris, as if you'd heard the news there, and a mayoral election. And one of the mayoral candidates had a suggestion for renovating these stations and converting them into, she's talking about theatres, art galleries, swimming pools. Now, that candidate actually lost the election, but it did start a conversation about what could possibly be done with these empty spaces. You know, I said that if you actually do happen to see one of them, you'll see that it's covered in graffiti. So that's proof that there are, you know, they're accessible and people are going in there. There's life there. They'll call themselves urban explorers going in there. And I think they'd probably not be too keen on the stations being renovated.
There's probably people living there, like there are living on the New York Metro.
You do find a lot of homeless people sheltering in the active stations. There are a lot of dangers, obviously, of going through, you know, to access
the track, yeah.
Well, to access these, you have to go through the track. So so I'm not sure if there's a permanent population down there. But actually, those unused metro stations, they're a tiny, tiny part of underground Paris. There's a vast network of tunnels. It's about 300 kilometres of tunnels, much deeper than the metro. They go as deep as 30 metres. And these are actually old quarries and mines. The very stone that built Paris, when you see the limestone buildings of Paris, that comes from underneath the city itself. Hundreds and hundreds of kilometres of unmapped, a lot of it unmapped tunnels and caverns and all kinds of things. And there are very dedicated explorers who illegally go down there. They call themselves cataphiles, which is lovers of the catacombs. And they go down there not just to explore, but also to throw parties, to throw dinner parties, to throw raves, to throw art exhibitions. There are not just cheap graffiti, but actually, you know, you're talking about more really beautiful street art. Some of them carving directly into the limestone. There are some sculptures down there, and it's very secretive. To actually get down there, you really have to work on it for months and try and get into one of these secret societies and see if you get the nod to be able to go down.
Oh, I see, like the little club. Do you know what? You should be the cultural correspondent for RTE in France, probably Europe. I'm just thinking out loud, because you really are super.
If that would give me an in into, because I'd love to be able to explore down there, you know, and actually, if that would give me an in with these secret societies,
well, tell them you're doing it for us.
I will.
Yeah. We'll have it. Put your headphones on for a moment, because Gary is on the phone. Hello, Gary, how are you?
Derek, how are you doing?
Very good to talk to you. Now, where are you calling from?
I'm actually calling from Dublin today, but I'm from Abbey Leaks.
And you're planning?
Planning to move the family to France in a little bit of an experiment for the summer months when the kids are off school. I've got two daughters who are 13 and 10.
Mm-hmm.
And we had myself and my wife sit down and had a discussion. And we said, you know what, we could actually live the dream now. And instead of trying to buy a place and do all sorts of silly things, we wanted to just rent somewhere and work remotely.
Now, do you live in Abbey Leaks, do you?
I do.
Okay.
I work in Dublin.
Have you got a home in Abbey Leaks?
I have.
And the job you're in, can you give it up for 3 months?
No, I can't, because I own my own business. It's a recruitment company called Canduco, and we're in Dublin. But I found that a lot of my work can be done remotely. So what we're looking at doing is moving everybody to France. My wife works in the business as well, and all of her work is done online. So that part of it was fine. And I'd have to be able to, come back reasonably flexibly in and out over the summer. So we need to get beside a cheap Ryanair hub.
Now, why France?
A couple of reasons. Well, we've been there a few times. We like France. We like the food. We like the language. I want my kids to learn the language. And I generally like nice weather.
And you generally get nice weather in France at certain times of the year, anyway.
Yeah, and you know, it's easy to travel to other places from there as well.
Now,
it's more affordable.
You'd still be making... Well, is it? So anyway, what do you want to ask, Siobhan?
Yeah, so, look, some people would think that we're daft. Our company is called Canduco, so we are can-do people. So we want advice on, I suppose, main point. You know, I know there's a thousand things you could ask, but main points on do's and don'ts.
Well, I would say, first of all, that France is actually a great country for kids. And it's a great place to bring kids up. You said that you wanted to be near a Ryanair hub. I mean, were you thinking Paris? Were you thinking the south of France?
No, south. We last year we were in Fréjus, and we liked that area down along there. So we were thinking maybe, I don't know, we're looking for somebody to suggest a place that's kid friendly, interesting. You know, I ride motorbikes for fun, so you know, it wants to be somewhere we can do stuff as well, not just sit around on the beach, you know.
I think the main issue for going over, if it's going to be 3 months, can you treat it as a bit of a holiday, and you can just try and get, say, you know, a holiday rental, and it'll be a little bit easier that way. If you think it's going to go on longer, there's going to be a lot of paperwork, but it's very important to get, because actually to be registered with the health service, to be registered for tax purposes, all that kind of thing, you're going to need to think about that. And how's your French?
There's another question. Actually, we do want to register in something structured, so that we don't just drift along for a summer and not really improve our French, Annie. So we would like to kind of see what options are there as a family to go and learn French, you know, not just send the kids off in the morning.
Well, I certainly before you can go, you can certainly explore the Alliance Française here in Ireland, or of course, a lot of local schools will do evening classes. So I would certainly suggest sooner rather than later. Okay. Getting into a French class, and once you're in France, you'll find, again, there's Alliance Française offices all over the country, but also there'll be local schools that will do their own, or even usually the local town halls will organise adult education as well. So I think the main issue will actually be finding a rental. And the problem, as I mentioned, in Paris anyway, rentals tend to be empty. They're not furnished, especially if you're doing this as an experiment for 3 months and you're not sure, is it going to go on longer? You're going to need to get...
We know it definitely won't go on longer because we've got commitments to school and stuff with kids. So.
Oh, in that case, yeah. If it's going to be just for the 3 months, then I think you don't actually have to worry about any of that kind of paperwork that I was talking about. I think you can just treat it as kind of an extended holiday, because in fact, if you want to register for a medical card in France, which everybody is entitled to, the thing is, by the time it actually comes, you'll kind of be ready to head home anyway. In the meantime, you still will be entitled to the same health coverage. It's just a little bit more, you know, rather than having a chip card, the medical card in France is just a little chip and pin card that we use. They'll give you if anything happens, if you need any medical treatment, you'll just get it on paper. So you're still entitled as a European citizen to the same care.
What about location wise? Where would you recommend?
Well, location. I mean, if you're talking about if you're talking about weather, if you really are there for the weather, certainly the south of France might be the place to go. You've got the large cities like the size of the likes of Marseille, which is the second city, which is the second biggest city in France. So you'll have all kinds of any kind of amenity you could imagine will be there. And I do believe, well, I'm not sure if Ryanair will fly there. You might want to check yourself if Ryanair fly directly there to Ireland. But, you know, other large cities like Nice, Montpellier, if you're not particularly tied to any city or any space, you might want to actually start by just looking at what kind of accommodation is available, because you will find it's more difficult to get furnished accommodation. That tends to be more tourist accommodation. You might find yourself having to pay over the odds for that.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to get a regular rental, it's going to be difficult because, first of all, just to get a rental in France, you have to have a very thick file of all kinds of... It's actually like applying for a mortgage anywhere else. You need to really have all kinds of tax information. They're going to want to have salary information. They're going to want to have all this kind of thing. And they want people who are going to sign a 3-year lease, a 5-year lease. So you might find that you need to just start looking at furnished accommodation. It's going to be expensive over the summer if it's the south of France, you know. So then maybe by staying in a city like Marseille, which is, rather than the little tourist spots, you know, you're in a city, you might actually find it's a little bit cheaper than the tourist spots, and you'll have all kinds of amenities there and easy to travel.
Well,
and
I would say go and do it, Gary. Apps, don't even think about it. Go and do it. Why not? You're dead right. Do it when you can do it, when you can enjoy it. Not when you're a cripple and you're kind of hobbling around the place.
The kids are a nice age, aren't they? They're what? They're 11 and 13, did you say, Gary?
10 and 13.
Perfect
yeah.
age nice, for travelling and everything.
Most days it's a nice age.
Yeah, they'll pick up the language even when they're there casually already at that age, very quickly.
No, they're learning French already, actually, locally. So.
That's perfect. And you know what? You'll find, I think, they'll absolutely soak it up in 3 months. And there'll be all kinds of summer activities for kids run by wherever you are, the local town hall, run by the local city. And, you know, you can send the kids out at 9 in the morning. They'll be out all day interacting with other, with French kids, really soaking up the language. And by the end of 3 months, they'll be half fluent already, I'd say.
Gary, we're going to have to say au revoir. To you at this stage, because I'm watching the clock. So thank you very much indeed. Just before we finish, thanks, Gary. Kevin has been on to say, don't forget that there are problems in the outer areas of Paris, riots and racial tensions, etc.
That's true. We haven't had major problems in a few years. There have been there have been riots. Really, young disaffected people. There are in the outskirts of Paris. You get. There's a lot of high rises, you know, the same. It looks a little bit like Ballymun used to look before the towers started coming down. And
it's two different cities. It really is when you're on the train.
And that's very much outside. There's inside the walls of Paris and there's outside the walls of Paris. And I mean, the youth unemployment levels are absolutely enormous. You know, in some areas, it's well over 50% youth unemployment.
Ooh, that's not good.
You know, we heard in the news that earlier that the socialists really took a drubbing at the local elections. You know, a couple of years after President François Hollande was elected, and his big promise was unemployment was going to get down to below 10%, and he hasn't been able to do it.
Do you think people reacted badly to him and to the party because of the affair?
In France,
what are people saying? I wonder.
In France, I think people see it more as a media problem. They think that it's his own business and the media shouldn't have been...
It is his own
been...
business.
Yeah, I mean, I just kind of wonder how he had time. You know, there are so many issues.
It's obviously not Metro... What's the other thing?
No, well, he was on a scooter. What's that? Metro Boulot Dodo, but
Metro Boulot Dodo, Boulot and he's Dodo. Adding something in the
he
middle
was,
of it.
Well, he was also on his moto. He was on his little
Metro
scooter.
Boulot Moto.
He was on his scooter going between the Elysee Palace on his scooter.
So
to
what? Who cares?
She goes, well, you know, and
you know, I'm just wondering though, is there a backlash? Is there a bit of reaction to that? The amount of publicity was extraordinary. So he's having an affair, big deal.
Yeah, I think honestly, French voters don't care about that very much.
But
at
do
all.
Most it's... people care about it? I wonder worldwide when you hear about people having affairs, are they doing their job? Are they doing anything illegal? Let them on with it. Let them sort it out between themselves, family-wise. Other than that, it's not really anybody's business. It really isn't.
I think in the United States, it would be the end of a career. But in France, it's almost seen as it'd be more shocking if politicians don't have affairs. You know, it's François Mitterrand, one of the most beloved presidents in France, had a secret daughter. Who, you know, the truth only came out after he died. I don't know. It's definitely seen as.
I wonder why should the truth even come out about a secret daughter? I mean, if he was good and kind and caring and looked after the secret daughter, you know,
which apparently he was, and he did.
So, I mean, Yeah, you know, I've never understood that kind of prying into people's lives like that. But at any rate, thank you very much indeed, Siobhan, for coming in.
You're very welcome.
It's great to meet you. And I really think you're a fantastic ambassador for Ireland in France and for France in Ireland. And the French Tourist Board, if you're listening, or the embassy, if you're listening, this lady should be appointed. That's what I, as a cultural ambassador, that's the role for you now. And given a massive salary and loads of affairs. That's what you deserve, now, Siobhan. Roger's been on to say English is the official language in India. It is estimated that 400 million people in India speak English. Likewise, in Nigeria, English is the official language. So another 100 million plus. Then South Africa, the countries of the West Indies, virtually every higher educated European, etc., etc. Do you really believe that French will overtake English as the majority language? Do you? Asks Roger. Personally, no.